The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right, greetings, America. Another extraordinary week in Washington, D.C. We're going to try and hit some of the policy highlights for you. Start out with healthcare reform, what's happening, and then we're going to move over to the world of financial reform, where things are moving very quickly in the United States Senate. And then with the release of the new plan for a national broadband plan, we're going to talk to you about the rollout of that advanced technology across the country and what the FCC has planned. Plus, we'll also recap some hot stories from D.C. and who we like in the Sweet 16. I'll give you a hint, I'm wearing an orange tie today. But let's start with health care reform. We have with us two of our frequent experts on health care policy, John Jonas and Marty Kendrick, to talk a little bit about what's going on in the Senate today, what action might be coming back to the House, and more importantly, what is going to happen now that President Obama has signed into law the historic health care reform. So, Marty, let's start with the 50,000-foot question. What's going to happen next?
Kevin, it's been a marathon week here. I anticipate that we could have the bill over the last finish line by late this evening. The action right now is on the Senate floor, where yesterday initially 232 amendments were filed and then an additional 100 amendments before the parliamentarian ruled on a couple of minor points of order. So the reconciliation bill that the House passed and sent to the Senate is slightly modified and is now waiting final disposition of amendments and debate on the Senate floor. The anticipated final Senate vote will occur this afternoon, and then the bill will be bounced back to the House for final approval. Majority Leader Hoyer put out an announcement earlier today stating that he anticipated that the final vote would occur this evening, Thursday evening. However, Speaker Pelosi has put the message out to the House that they should be prepared to stay in session through Monday. There's obviously some other business, but I think that's a safety net because, as we've all learned in this healthcare debate, it's not over till it's over. But if luck goes with the Democrats today, then the final bill will be passed by this evening and will be headed toward the president's desk at that point.
Well, let's get into, you know, the president signed this bill roughly 48 hours ago, almost exactly 48 hours ago. He was joined by, I think, virtually every elected Democrat in the House of Representatives and the Senate, not a single Republican joining him for the signing ceremony over at the White House for this historic day. But, John, I know lots of people now just sort of sitting down to absorb the bill and trying to get a sense of what happens immediately and what is still years off into the distance. So can you walk us through the near term? What provisions are now law and are taking effect today, and what things, we'll get to in a minute, what things are a few years off in the distance?
Yeah, thanks very much, Kevin. You're absolutely right. This is an enormous bill affecting one-sixth of the U.S. economy, and that's obviously engendered a lot of the controversy around the bill. So you can look at this as a huge battleship that's very slowly going to be turned in kind of a different direction. So, yes, things are going to play out, quite frankly, over the over an entire decade, probably the final provisions will ultimately go into effect by about 2020. So we've got a very long process ahead of us, and probably a fair amount of continued controversy and debate about some of the provisions, and including, I think you've obviously seen some of the early court filings by states around the individual mandate. But there are a bunch of provisions that go into effect very quickly. I think the early provisions will be quite popular with the American public. They include among the following: one, the process of beginning to fill the so-called donut hole being a typical Washington kind of phrase that covers the coinsurance amount that Medicare beneficiaries pay for their drug coverage under what's called Medicare Part D. They're going to get immediately some assistance, about $250 worth of assistance in covering those coinsurance costs. And then slowly over time, the coinsurance requirements for Medicare beneficiaries in the so-called donut hole will close, and you will have complete insurance coverage for your Medicare drug benefit. A number of insurance reforms are going to go into effect within the next 6 months. Among them are allowing your kids up to the age of 26. I know, Kevin, you have young children, and you probably don't think of them as being your kids until they're age 26, but for health insurance purposes, they're going to be able to stay on your policy. And given the hard economic times and the difficulty of getting coverage, that's going to be a plus, I think, for many families. Pre-existing condition requirements for kids are going to disappear. So if your child has a pre-existing condition, the insurance company can't turn them down immediately. It takes a longer time for that to kick in for the rest of the population. Insurance companies won't be able to kick you off an existing policy because you have developed an ailment. So I think we're slowly going to begin to see some important changes in the insurance market, and a fair number of them in the next 6 months.
Very interesting. Well, talk to us then, Marty, a little bit about the provisions that are further out. John mentioned it'll be a while rolling out the pre-existing conditions for adults, but I know that many of the provisions don't trigger for 5 or 6 years. Talk to us about some of those things.
Well, some of the more challenging delivery system reforms and changes to the delivery system, and particularly where the Department of Health and Human Services or the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services have responsibilities for implementing provisions, the number of those kinds of changes are a little bit further out. For example, some of the integration of integrated health systems, some of the linking payments more to quality outcomes, some of the administrative simplification requirements, the medical device excise tax, for example, was a big victory in getting that pushed off to an effective date of 2013. There is, there's some provisions that just are going to take longer to sort out, and because of the cost side of it as well, some were kicked out into the future. So a number of the increased access and some of the the phasing in, for example, the small business tax credit has both a short-term provision, but there's an additional second phase that for other qualified small employers that doesn't kick in until the year 2014. The excise tax on high-cost employer-provided health benefits is not effective until 2018. So there's been some calculation, and just to underscore what John said, I mean, hopefully some of the real benefits to consumers will be appreciated by people early on. I mean, one example is the preventive care under Medicare. There's an elimination of copayments that takes effect January 1st of 2011, and it also 6 months after enactment, insurers will no longer be able to, you know, kick people off plans or drop people from coverage when they get sick. So, you know, it's a long trajectory between now and when the, you know, final provisions are effective in this bill. So we're going to be living with the after effects of health care reform for a long time.
Now, John, you mentioned in one of your earlier answers that states have started to take action, and it seems like you know, state attorneys general have grouped together in a couple of different lawsuits, one challenging, I believe, the right of the Congress to impose on everyone the purchasing of health insurance, and some on some other grounds. Can you talk to us about those grounds and also, at least from the Washington perspective, what the likelihood of success of those lawsuits is viewed as?
Yeah, I think, you know, from a lawyer's perspective, though these lawsuits are certainly very interesting. Some of them may have some inspired politically, but from a legal perspective, I think they present some interesting questions, and that question really centers around what are the outer parameters of the so-called Commerce Clause of the Constitution, which allows the federal government power to regulate commerce in and between the states. It's been a area of historical constitutional battle in the past. Much of it, I think, early in this century, as the government extended its reach over the economy, not as much in the recent past. But the argument really boils down to: can the federal government require somebody to affirmatively buy insurance? It's different than, I think, the government's well-recognized power to say, you know, that this item is safe or unsafe, or we need to regulate sort of various aspects of commerce for health and safety reasons, food inspection, drug inspection, speed limits, all of that kind of stuff falls under the broad Commerce Clause authority. But there clearly is a question of, is this at the outer boundaries of the Commerce Clause? And I think it'll make for some interesting debate and some very interesting litigation. I've looked at some of the constitutional law experts' kind of early thinking on this. They seem to be leaning in the direction that this probably is constitutional, but it's, as I say, Kevin, a very good question, and independent branch of our government, and the courts will have to have at it and come up with a decision. If they declare that unconstitutional, it is a central part of the health care reform agenda. It is very important to have broad-based coverage to support some of the insurance reform, so individuals don't game the system, you know, wait until they're sick to buy insurance that an insurance company then is mandated to sell to them. So that being struck down by the courts, I think, would be, I don't think a mortal blow to health care reform, but would require some pretty major surgery to the system that the Congress established.
Interesting, and we got about just 30 seconds left, so quickly your senses of who health care reform favors in November, Republicans or Democrats? Quick answer, John and Marty.
You know, I think it's close, because I think on the one hand it benefits Democrats because there's a great need for reforming the health care system. I think it benefits Republicans because there's a lot of concern about government commitments, expenditure commitments out into the future for which the taxpayer may not be willing or ready to pay the tab. So,
Marty, Republicans or Democrats benefit most from passage?
I agree with John's analysis. I guess I'd come down on the side of Democrats benefit the most, and particularly because Republicans really never offered a genuine alternative to vote up or down. So I think it's going to be hard for them to face the electorate as in a position of negative without constructive alternatives.
All right, well, we will leave it there. We'll have you guys back, I know, many times more to talk about reform. We'll be back to talk about financial reform next.
stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202- 457-6000.
It's all about action.
Touchdown!
Scores.
Taking a look at the NBA tonight.
Highlights.
He's broken loose. He's at the 30.
And headlines.
Big trade in the NFL this afternoon.
When you are looking to talk sports, look no further than the Voice America Sports Network. We bring you some of the biggest names and all the sports news you can handle, whether it's basketball.
Off the glass.
Football.
Come on. Boom.
Golf, racing, or the Olympics. We've got you covered. We'll even cover tailgating. Tune in to the Voice America Sports Network. It's all things sports.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The house will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs, straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back to Capital Thinking. Well, one of the things that seems to be next up on the legislative agenda is financial reform, in many ways forced to take a back seat to health care over the first 15 months of the Obama administration, at least on the legislative front, if not the regulatory front. Joining us for this segment are two of our resident political experts, on the right, Mark Ross, and on the left, Vince Ferlicci. Gentlemen, we're going to start with you, Vince, and talk to us a little bit about what's happening in the Senate. The House has already passed its regulatory reform bill, and Monday evening, in a surprising move, Chairman Chris Dodd of Connecticut, Chairman of the Banking Committee, had a 20-minute markup of the financial reform bill, and then it passed on a straight party-line vote. What's up with that?
Well, Kevin, it's good to be with you. Yeah, it was probably the quickest markup in Senate history after spending about 14 months talking about health care. It was a real different example. 21 minutes to pass a 1,300-page bill through committee. You're right, at a party line vote. What happened actually was that over the previous weekend, Senator Corker suggested about 100 amendments to Chairman Dodd's bill that was issued on the 15th, and then Senator Shelby added another 100 amendments on top of that. And so Senator Dodd and Senator Shelby had a conversation about sort of sitting down and discussing how to create a new bill in a way that probably made more sense than trying to discuss 200 amendments. And there were also 150 amendments from Democratic members of the committee. And so the bill that the senator put out, Senator Dodd put out on the 15th, with some technical amendments and some amendments from the Democrats, was passed by the committee. So now that's out of committee, and that can go to the floor at any point, but Chairman Dodd and Chairman Shelby have recommitted to have discussions, bilateral discussions, over the next few weeks to see how to try to create a bipartisan agreement. So whatever does happen, whether it be a new bipartisan bill or this bill that was passed out of the committee, it seems the intent of Majority Leader Reid and Chairman Dodd to move a bill to the floor sometime in if not late April, sometime in May. Although everything being what it is in the Senate, you know, maybe it could become June, June could become July. So I think that's a pretty detailed coverage. So just the process side of what's going on.
The once you get past May, you get in real trouble with election year. Well, Mark, let's come over to you. And talk a little bit about Republican strategy. How are they going to handle the politics of regulatory reform after this grueling battle with reconciliation and health care reform? It seems like there are landmines for the Republicans in how they handle this and how they interact with the Democrats.
Well, I think unlike the health care bill, there is agreement on both sides of the aisle that this something has to be passed. Like, obviously, what happened to our economy over the last few years is unacceptable, and clearly, additional regulations need to be put in place. So clearly something is going to happen. I don't foresee any issue not being passed. I guess the key thing is what's in the bill. That's where the biggest problems have laid. And I think it'll be tough for any politician on either side of the aisle to face voters this fall without having addressed financial reform.
Gotcha. That's I think there is real danger there to be seen on the side of Wall Street instead of on the side of Main Street. Now, Vince, it seems like we got three very interesting personalities at the top end of this process in the Senate. We've got Chris Dodd, the retiring chairman of the Banking Committee from Connecticut, Dick Shelby, the ranking Republican on that committee, and then a fairly junior senator, Bob Corker, from Tennessee, who sort of stepped into the void when Shelby was unwilling to negotiate to sort of present the Republican viewpoint in conjunction with Dodd. So talk to us a little bit about what each of those guys might be thinking strategically as compared to the president and maybe even Majority Leader Reid about this bill.
Well, yeah, I think first of all, I think Chairman Dodd, to dovetail on what Mark just said about the majority of Americans wanting to do something, therefore not political yet, also having to do something that people actually feel they can understand is the challenge of Chris Dodd right now. I mean, when you talk about merging the office of the comptroller of the currency with the office of thrift supervision, I mean, people's just eyes glaze over, right? But
people didn't even know we had those offices.
I know, right. I mean, I think that the challenge for Dodd is to, when you're talking about too big to fail and living wills for financial companies, is to talk about Lehman Brothers. When you're talking about consumer protection, talk about subprime mortgages and some of the challenges people had or that they say they had regarding some of the loans and the process around that when they got their mortgages. And I talk about things like independent funding from the SEC and a less politically driven SEC and how that may have stopped or may stop future Madoffs. I mean, I think that's the challenge for Dodd, is how do you take something that's really arcane and make people understand what it is. On Senator Shelby, as you said correctly, there was a time when Senator Shelby and Senator Dodd stopped communicating with each other, and so Senator Dodd had an offer from Senator Corker, as you said, a very junior member of the Republican side of the committee, that he wanted to do a negotiation with him about a bipartisan bill, and they talked for a very long time, and then that ended. And now Senator Shelby is back at the table, and so Senator Dodd is negotiating with the person that he wanted to negotiate with, from what we know since the beginning, that his ranking member, his equal, so to speak, on the committee. So, you know, it's a little bit of a melodrama. I mean, not that many people have, you know, probably cared or watched it closely like people in Washington, but, you know, I think that, and I would go back to Mark and sort of ask, you know, why you think Senator Shelby is back negotiating again and not simply making, you know, Senator Dodd take a partisan bill to the floor, you know?
Well, now, Vince, this is my show. You're not allowed to ask Mark.
Sorry, well, I mean, I think that's the question, though, when you talk about the personalities involved, is, I mean, that's sort of the current question of the moment. And I think Bob Corker is, unfortunately, he is now sort of in a game of musical chairs.
Yeah,
he is missing a chair now.
He's the fulcrum of these negotiations. So, Mark, we'll let Vince ask his question sort of indirectly. What do you think Corker seems to be out on his own, and as a junior member in the Senate, that brings the opportunity for great glory, but it also brings the opportunity for resentment and long-term problems in the caucus. Talk to us about what you think Corker is trying to accomplish here.
Sure. First thing I'll say, Senator Corker is one of my favorite elected officials we have in the government, and one of my favorite senators, and I don't say that lightly. It's hard to identify some real champions up there. But Corker, you know, he comes from a business background. Here's a man who started some businesses in his 40s, sold them at a great profit, and did some missionary work, and came back and got very involved in the city of Chattanooga with both nonprofit and for-profit enterprises. So I think he is at the front lines of this issue. Like, he understands finance. He's actually built things. He's met a payroll. He's had to borrow money to build projects. And he sees it from a totally different angle. Like, he's just recently, I think his youth, you know, which is sometimes not a good thing. I mean, he was just out there a few years ago building a business. So he knows what's happening. And I think that's a huge, huge advantage. It shouldn't be discounted. And Corker's really positioned himself, even during the GM bailout, the automotive bailout, he was at front and center of this issue. And I think his, what you may be decrying as his youth and inexperience, is a big asset here. I do think that he wants to see something happen. I do think Corker, in some ways, is a bit frustrated by the process. I mean, this is an issue that has to be addressed. And sometimes our government, as great as it is, it becomes too burdensome to actually do the right thing. And there's a bit of frustration kind of playing by the old rules. And I think Corker is kind of stepping up, you know, from his business perspective and saying, we got to make something happen here. Let's, you know, quit wasting time and get going.
Yeah, I agree. That seems to be his primary motivation, not political in nature, but trying to accomplish something. Hey, Vince, I want to come back to you and ask about one of the freshmen on your side of the aisle that I think is also standing out in this process, and that's Virginia's Mark Warner. He really seems to be sort of quietly working with the chairman and across party lines to work on some very substantive parts of this bill. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Back about four or five months ago, maybe a little more, Senator Dodd invited members of the committee on both sides of the aisle to form small working groups to take pieces of this this bill and mold them together. And one of those groups was Senator Corker and Senator Warner. And they wrote the resolution authority section, which is this new mandate that's large, financial, systemically risky. The term is, which is the definition that they're still defining, what is systemically risky. Organizations that meet that characterization will have to have a living will and be wound down. So therefore, you wouldn't have a situation in the Corker-Warner work that they've done in this section. Again, you wouldn't have a Lehman Brothers instant failing situation again, and then the domino behind it, because each company would have a living will and everyone would know how it would get wound down by, I think, the FDIC, although they're still negotiating who would actually do it. And I think that the interesting thing about Senator Warner is he worked for Chairman Dodd back in the early 80s for a while. So they have a personal relationship that precedes their work together in the Senate Banking Committee. And to Mark's point, Senator Warner is interesting because he made his career after being a staffer in a young age. He made a career for himself in business, a very successful businessman in the wireless industry. So he, like Senator Corker, have business background. So I think that's a really interesting team. And I think on the Corker piece, one last thing, I think people shouldn't forget that about 50 or 70% of what Senator Corker negotiated with Senator Dodd before this bill passed the committee is in this bill they passed out of committee. And so Senator Corker should be applauded for stepping up and being willing to work in a partisan atmosphere and for getting some changes to the bill that makes it better for business.
We're going to leave it there. Vince and Mark, thanks for joining us. We'll have you back on soon. We're going to talk about national broadband rollout plans next after the break.
Whether the market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Technology is changing the way we live our lives and how we do business. On CIO Talk Radio, we talk about the benefits of technology and the great things it allows us to do, as well as its risks. Heard every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, Sunjoy Gall interviews business leaders and other experts that are shaping the way we use technology. To learn more about the show, visit www.ciotalkradio.com. Keep up with the changing world of technology and listen to CIO Talk Radio with Sunjoy Gall. Listen in every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, right here on Voice America Business.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hola.
Konnichiwa.
Bonjour.
Hello.
From Anchorage to Abu Dhabi.
Marhaba.
From Denver to Doha.
Ciao.
Patton Boggs makes business transactions the world over.
Oi.
Rely on our insights for your next deal. Patton Boggs, the international business team. Straight, unfiltered, Patton Boggs.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
Okay, well, many of you remember we've been talking about the National Broadband Plan and things related to broadband stimulus funding for quite a while, and we're going to spend some time in this segment talking about it as well. Joining us are Jennifer Setta, a telecommunications attorney in Washington, D.C., who's been on in the past talking to us about the broadband stimulus funding in particular, and also Rebecca Thompson, one of Jennifer's colleagues from Washington, who is here on her maiden voyage on Capital Thinking. So, Rebecca, welcome to you. Jennifer, welcome back to you. And let's start with telling us a little bit about the National Broadband Plan and why the Federal Communications Commission has undertaken this unique initiative.
Great. Thanks, Kevin. Thanks. Good to be here. The FCC undertook this initiative first and foremost because Congress directed them to develop a national broadband plan. In the stimulus bill, in addition to allocating over $7 billion for broadband infrastructure, Congress required the FCC to develop a national broadband plan to ensure that every American has access to broadband capability. Congress also required that this plan include a detailed strategy about how to advance public safety, homeland security, healthcare, energy independence, education, just to name a few. So the FCC's plan focuses on how broadband can improve these areas of our economy. So the plan makes six main goals and has over 200 recommendations, quite a large undertaking. But without congressional action, the FCC can't do much. The plan is just a plan. There aren't rules in the plan. So the FCC will have to undertake notice and comment rulemaking to accomplish most of what's said in the plan. The FCC also undertook this initiative because the current administration is not pleased with current U.S. broadband rankings, as broadband relates to adoption or access. And it's not clear, there's a debate right now of over whether the FCC actually has the authority to implement the recommendations in the plan. So to give a little legal background, today broadband is classified as what's called an information service under Title I of the Communications Act. And under Title I, broadband services aren't regulated like what's called common carrier or traditional telecommunications services. The court has found that the FCC, however, has ancillary authority or ancillary jurisdiction to regulate matters that fall within its general jurisdiction but not directly addressed by the Communications Act. So that's how the FCC can act today. In the plan, the FCC proposes three possible ways to accomplish its recommendations. The first is that Congress could enact legislation to direct the FCC to regulate broadband. The FCC could rely on its current ancillary authority under Title I, or the FCC could reclassify broadband as a telecommunications service under Title II of the Communications Act.
Which of those, Rebecca, you outlined the options. Which of those do you think is the most likely path for the FCC to take?
Well, that's a good question, actually. I would have said even up until yesterday that the FCC would likely reclassify broadband under Title II, but the debate is still going on, and statements by the FCC chairman, Jenikowski, today make that unclear. They could just rely on their ancillary authority under Title I. So the plan didn't address this. I guess this remains to be seen and actually could be decided in court.
Interesting. Well, Jennifer, we have not forgotten about you, so let's talk with you a little bit about the plan. The FCC, I think Rebecca just said, has made over 200 recommendations in its plan. Talk to us a little bit about that.
That's right, Kevin. You can imagine that's an enormous undertaking, 200 recommendations. But what's worth noting about this plan before we get into some of the details is its unique structure. This is really the first time that the FCC has told Congress what it needs in order to execute this plan. Many of the 200 recommendations, as Rebecca may have mentioned, direct Congress to make statutory changes to enable the FCC to fulfill its key goals in the plan. But the plan also takes a comprehensive look at connecting broadband to essential community facilities like hospitals, schools, libraries, electric utilities, and first responders, public safety. So in order to achieve those aims, other federal agencies like the Education Department, Commerce, Energy Departments, they may also need to implement reforms. So you're looking at action from other agencies besides the FCC, in addition to any sort of statutory fixes that Congress will have to enact.
Very interesting. This is all very complex, isn't it? What about, you obviously probably haven't fully digested 200 different proposals and recommendations, but what do you think are the most important or relevant proposals out of what you've seen so far?
Well, our TEPCOM group actually has digested all of them, so
so that's it's been why a couple we can... late nights, then I'm sure.
That's right, but as Jennifer said, it's a huge undertaking, and the plan sets an agenda for the commission for the next 10 years on several issues. And I chose four that I think could really shape how broadband is used today, what the FCC is calling the broadband ecosystem. The first is sort of what's being referred to as the centerpiece of the plan, and it's Chairman Jenikowski's 100 Squared initiative, which basically means that the FCC wants broadband to reach 100 million households at a minimum of 100 megabits per second, and I believe he wants to achieve that by 2020.
And how does that compare to what are the current numbers on both those? Do you know?
I don't know the exact numbers. I know that our adoption, according to the FCC's studies, U.S. adoption rate now is about 65%.
I mean, I still...
And they're trying to reach 90%. So
I still use a 2400-bit modem dial-up, so it sounds like a good number to me.
We're going to connect you, Kevin.
Tell me a little bit about some of the other relevant proposals.
Right.
I didn't mean to interrupt you, Rebecca.
No worries. So another one is reform of the set-top box, or otherwise known as the cable boxes on top of your TVs. And reform of set-top boxes could allow for delivering internet video to a consumer's TV. But lack of competition in the set-top box market is currently competing this convergence of internet over the TV. And the FCC hopes that its proposals to open up the set-top box market will allow more than just cable or satellite providers into consumers' home. To give you a little background on where we are today, the FCC's set-top cable box, or what they're calling navigation devices, apply only to cable operators. So the FCC has proposed to initiate a rulemaking seeking comment on how to ensure that all providers, all multi-channel video programming distributors, cable satellite providers, but not just cable operators, can install a gateway device or something equivalent in all subscribers' homes and in all homes requiring replacement of these older set-top boxes, starting no later than December of 2012. And even more recent than that, the FCC hopes to adopt rules possibly by this fall to fix certain cable card issues to allow internet over your cable box. So it is rumored that these initiatives will happen fast, possibly even a vote as early as next month at the commission.
Go ahead, Rebecca.
Another big issue is spectrum, and the FCC seems to be focusing on bringing down the cost for entry into wireless broadband markets. They recognize the high capital cost that is invested in both wireline and wireless, but in particularly in wireline, so they've sort of focused their energy on this, the wireless market. But to do this, to create more competition, they have to free up spectrum over which broadband providers can run their latest applications and new technologies. So the commission has proposed, in coordination with NTIA, making 500 megahertz of spectrum available for broadband within 10 years, and of that 500 megahertz within 5 years, making 300 megahertz of spectrum available for mobile use. And the FCC hopes to fulfill this 300 megahertz goal for mobile use by 2015. The FCC is also proposing to conduct incentive auctions where an incumbent licensee can relinquish its current spectrum to other parties or to the FCC, and in return, the incumbent licensee would receive a portion of proceeds generated by that auction. As a part of this, and probably one of the more controversial recommendations in the plan, the FCC is proposing to reallocate 120 megahertz from the broadcast TV bands. So broadcasters currently have 6 megahertz channels, and the FCC is recommending that we revise spectrum allocations to ensure efficient use of these 6 megahertz channels and to establish a new framework to permit two or more stations to possibly share these 6 megahertz channels. And the FCC is hoping that the incentive auctions that they've proposed will encourage broadcasters to relinquish some of their spectrum.
Rebecca. We're going to have to take a commercial break, but we're having a great discussion here, and if you guys can hang on the line, I'd like to come back after the commercial break and cover the rest. We'll be back in just a moment.
Whether the market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street
to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Stuart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Stuart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Stuart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business,
you'll find the experts here.
Voice America Business Network. From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, well, we are talking with Rebecca Thompson and Jennifer Setta, two talented telecommunications lawyers from Washington, D.C., walking us through some of the details of the FCC's rollout of their national broadband plan, which has been happening this week. And when we left our story, Rebecca was telling us about reallocation of 120 megahertz from broadcast TV bands. And I want to turn to Jennifer and have Jennifer talk to us a little bit about some of the auctions that are coming up and public safety issues.
Sure, Kevin. One of the key goals of the plan that the FCC contemplates fulfilling is the creation of a nationwide interoperable wireless broadband network for public safety. This is an outgrowth, if you can recall, of the 9/11 Commission's report. After 9/11, the Commission came out and said that there was a need for a nationwide wireless broadband network, but we've not been able to achieve that, obviously, since. The plan is important because it would dedicate $6.5 billion over 10 years to the operating and capital costs of the plan. Actually, the expected total cost would be $16 billion. There's actually an oversight hearing that's going on right now in the House Energy and Commerce Subcommittee on Communications Technology and the Internet, and there's a very vigorous discussion about how much funding is actually needed for this network. Chairman Waxman, who chairs the House Energy and Commerce Committee, said he's actually drafting legislation right now to authorize that 6.5 or the total $16 billion for this network. But one of the more controversial elements of the plan would call for re-auctioning of a 10 megahertz piece of spectrum in the 700 megahertz band called the D-block spectrum. The public safety community had wanted this spectrum as a means to lay out their nationwide network. But in its broadband plan, the FCC determined that that should be re-auctioned for commercial uses as opposed to reallocated for public safety uses. So there's actually a big debate among the public safety agencies, about 15 public safety agencies that would still like to see this 10 megahertz of spectrum allocated to help implement this nationwide public safety network, especially for advanced technologies that would allow them to use biometrics or look at blueprints out in the field when they're on a SWAT team action, for instance, or even running license plate reports out in the field. They view this 10 megahertz as a crucial aspect of their plan. However, what we heard today from Chairman Waxman and questioning Chairman Jenikowski, who's testifying before the committee, is that there is complete agreement not only with Chairman Jenikowski, but the other FCC commissioners that this 10 megahertz should actually be reallocated for commercial use, because, as Rebecca said, there is an overarching plan by the chairman to unleash spectrum for wireless broadband purposes for commercial use. And there's agreement that perhaps public safety has the necessary spectrum they need, and it's really a matter of funding that will get them to the end goal with this nationwide network. So we'll probably see that being played out in the next few weeks as Congress crafts its legislation, and we get a better sense of how that funding is going to be achieved, whether it's through a congressional authorization or creating efficiencies within the FCC. I think a little bit of that is unclear right now.
Well, Rebecca and Jennifer, this sounds like we're at the beginning of a long road to much of this. So what has to happen next for the FCC in order to start seeing them fulfill their goals, have the kind of impact that they want? Rebecca, why don't you take that one?
Right. So it is a long road, and at least from the FCC standpoint, it's at least a 10-year road. But just to be clear, the plan is just a plan. There's no rules adopted in the plan. There's just recommendations on how to improve broadband. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, it's not clear whether the commission has authority to act on many of its recommendations. The FCC has said that it will publish a timetable of proceedings, notice and comment proceedings, in order to implement the plan's recommendations that are currently within its authority, and that
actually, Rebecca, just to let you know, Chairman Jenikowski at today's hearing indicated that implementation schedule should be forthcoming within the next week or so. So we should get a better sense of the timetable for implementation.
Right, and I know that certain of the topics we've talked about are going to be more pressing, like, for example, the reform of set-top boxes. So look for that. But regardless, the implementation of the plan requires a long-term commitment from not just the FCC, but from the executive branch and Congress in coordination with state and local government. The impact of the plan on consumers and companies is not yet completely clear because the devil's in the details. So we'll have to wait to see when these proceedings are developed and what the commission is proposing in those proceedings to see how they're exactly going to impact us.
Now, we have just a couple of minutes left. Jennifer, I want to turn to you and ask about an update on where the stimulus broadband money is, what stage it's at right now.
You know what, I can take that, Kevin.
Sure.
What we've seen is none of our clients have seen money yet. As I noted in the beginning, the stimulus bill allocated $7.2 billion to fund construction of broadband or for broadband infrastructure. There were two filing windows. I think Jennifer and another colleague of ours explained all this to you in another call, but there were two filing windows, the second of which will be closing early next week. In that first round of funding, there was $4 billion allocated, and so far only $1.5 billion of that has been awarded. And from what we can tell, none of that has been received by awardees, but they are now receiving loan and grant documents. So we hope that money will start hitting the marketplace within the next 60 to 90 days.
The check is in the mail is what you're telling me.
So to speak.
Well, I've got about 2 minutes left. Let me come back to you, Jennifer, to sort of wrap it up on any next steps that we haven't gotten to talk about from the FCC's perspective.
Sure. Kevin, as we were talking about with respect to the public safety component of the plan, there are many recommendations that require financial resources. So we'll be looking in the next few weeks to see what sort of plan the FCC crafts to give to Congress in seeking this funding request and what whether Congress feels like-minded with respect to funding some of these recommendations. But I also think, as Rebecca mentioned, there will be new legislation that will be introduced, and we already see that there are efforts underway, for instance, in the area of universal service reform to expand that legacy program to include broadband connectivity. And so Chairman Boucher on the House subcommittee side is well underway toward introducing a plan. Congressman Markey, for instance, and Senator Rockefeller are looking at discrete support mechanisms within the universal service fund. So there's definitely legislative work underway, and I'm sure that this will be a very active Congress with respect to assisting the FCC in reaching its goals.
Well, ladies, thank you so much for enlightening us on the broadband plans at the FCC. We will certainly have you back on to talk about developments as circumstances warrant. Folks, everybody have a great week. The Orange Men are going to the Final Four. They're going to prevail over Butler tonight. Enjoy the Sweet 16, and we'll be back with Hot Topics from Washington next week on Capital Thinking.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.
The Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.